My name is C.S. Song, and I'm joined by the two editors of a unique and very interesting volume entitled Tales for Little Rebels, which collects 44 stories and children's texts written by a number of people, people you might, recognize, like Dr. Seuss and Sid Hoff, but also a range of people in the early, mid, and even late 20th centuries whose work Julia and Phil are trying to recover and allow their readers to discover. Julia teaches American Studies at University of Texas at Austin, and Philip teaches English at Kansas State University, where he directs the program in children's literature. Julia, I know one of your passions or passionate interests relates to science and children's literature, and we could spend a whole hour, as we could, on really any of the topics in this book. But let me ask you about what progressive educators have thought over the years about the power of science education to help young people develop in political ways.
Sure. I guess I should say that rather than it being a passionate interest of mine, it became an interest because in writing my first book, I found that probably the main area in which radicals were writing, the main area of children's literature that radicals were writing in was science, and this seemed really strange to me. I couldn't figure out, if you were trying to get a political message across, why would you be writing about science? And so it became a passion in the sense that I had this question that I wanted to understand. What I did find was maybe what should have been obvious to me in the first place, which is that learning about science is a good way, and progressive educators felt it was a good way to teach children critical thinking. There was the notion that if children are able to understand how the world works, they will be empowered, in addition to critical thinking, they will also be empowered to change the world if they see how it works. Science also teaches people to question everything, to question received authority, to use the scientific method, to experiment for themselves. During the period in which the Communist Party had its greatest influence, there were many like I said, International Publishers Young World Series, more than half of their books were on scientific subjects. Hmm. And I was actually able to interview the editor of that series before she died. She actually lived in Berkeley in a nursing home for old radicals. Very interesting place. And I said, so why were you trying to get all these science books published? And she looked at me like I was stupid and said, well, to teach dialectical materialism, of course, which was this kind of really bald notion that if kids learned about science, they would become Marxists, obviously, from a bald Marxist perspective. So, beyond that, some of the different ways that radicals have used science, like I said, challenging racism being an important goal, you could use science, particularly anthropology, but also biology, to show that scientific, pseudoscientific notions about racial hierarchy really have no basis in science, that differences come out of environment. You could also use science to show the ways that things are all interconnected. I think a good example of that is a story like Charlotte Pomerance's The Day They Parachuted Cats Over Borneo, which shows the kind of unintended chain of consequences from using DDT.
Yeah, can you synopsize that story? It's a fascinating one, and this relates to the fact that because DDT was used to kill malaria-causing or carrying mosquitoes in Borneo, eventually they resorted to literally dropping cats from outside Borneo onto that island. Tell us about the story briefly.
Well, I should also say about the story is that it has wonderful illustrations, and many of these stories have wonderful illustrations. X, that Phil was talking about, also has great illustrations. And it's a really, I mean, it's a very serious problem, but it's actually one of the funnier stories in the book, and very lighthearted in the way that it's written. And I feel like I have to share, my five-year-old daughter is so obsessed with this story that she wants her whole birthday party, for her sixth birthday party, to be a performance of this story, and she's already cutting out cats and rats and other things to perform with. But I could read you a tiny section from the beginning. I am the island of Borneo, where the farmer, poor farmer, bends low. I have honey bears, rhinos, and tiger cats. Great falcons, flamingos, and foxy-faced bats. I have gold and quicksilver, rubber and rice, cane sugar and spice, but not everything nice. A land of harsh ridges and savage monsoon, of jungles as dark as the dark of the moon, land of thundering rains and earthquakes and heat, where the farmer's life is more bitter than sweet, land of mosquitoes which carry with ease the dreaded malaria, scourge, and disease. And this tells about how they brought in DDT to kill the mosquitoes. The DDT tried to kill the mosquitoes, but didn't kill the cockroaches. I'm not going to be able to follow the whole line of logic. Mm-hmm. There's cockroaches, lizards, geckos, rats, cats, and all of these things that, you know, it didn't kill the cockroaches, the caterpillars.
Eating the roofs.
Yeah, the caterpillars were eating the roof. There's this whole chain of events where animals are, you know, getting sick and eating each other, and things are collapsing. And it ends with them parachuting cats down, and then there's a message from an ecologist who explains how ecology works. And that bit might get a little heavy-handed for the kids, but it was apparently based on a real article that Charlotte Pomerantz, the author, found in the New York Times about, you know, bringing cats in to solve this problem. And she's somebody who we Phil and I got to meet recently, and she talked about being really intrigued by this chain of events that kind of reminds you of the old story of the woman who swallowed the fly and the chain of things that kept happening after that.
Certainly would promote, I would imagine, in its readers, a sense of ecological connectedness. We just have a few minutes left. Phil Nell, what is your sense of the overall quality of the tales you and Julia have collected? Some people might think, well, you know, something that's political or more baldly political, as are some of the stories in this collection, that you would perhaps inevitably sacrifice a certain literary quality if you were to try and inject explicit political messages in there. What's your opinion?
I think that's a myth about the left, that the left has no sense of humor. But in fact, many of these stories are lively, are engaging, are fun, are funny. As Julia pointed out in The Day they Parachuted Cats on Borneo, it's true. There are a few that are quite sectarian, that are quite obviously political, so obviously so that they actually border on self-parody, at least from a contemporary point of view, such as Art Young's The Socialist Primer, where we see a spider and he asks, "What is its other name?" That's right, the capitalist system. But for the most part, the stories are not that didactic. They're not that, hit you over the head with their politics, and are fun and are lively, and I think should find an audience among contemporary readers.
And in the final minute, Phil, is it your sense that a tale that stresses imagination and that encourages a child's imagination, that tale is to some degree already radical?
It could be. I mean, there's a debate about this. Certainly the idea that the imagination can be revolutionary has had many supporters, from the Romantics to nonsense poets to student radicals of the 60s who proclaimed all power to the imagination. While the imagination doesn't necessarily always create good, what it can do is it can help people recognize that what does exist now is not necessarily what ought to exist, or what might exist in the future. And that's why we have a whole section on the imagination, including, for example, The Teacup Whale by Lydia Gibson, which is a story about a little boy who brings home a very, very small whale. which his mother insists is a polywog, but he insists it's a whale, and it grows, and it gets larger, and the mother keeps insisting it's a polywog, and he keeps insisting it's a whale, and then finally, at the end, we see that it is a whale, and his mother admits that it's a whale, and if you want to read that as radical, what you might say is that it encourages children to believe in their big dreams, to discount the advice of doubters, and to follow their own sense of what feels right and true, and that sense is how the imagination can be radical, and that's why we have a section on it in the book.
We have a link to Tales for Little Rebels on our website, againstthegrain.org. Phil Nell and Julia Mickenberg have co-edited it. In fact, on againstthegrain.org, you'll also find Julia's book, Learning from the Left, as well as Philip Nell's homepage at Kansas State University. Thanks to both of you for joining us today.
Thanks so much. It was really fun.
Yes, thanks for having us.
Fun for me, too. And this is CS suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we will look for you next time. Against the Grain is produced by C.S. Song with associate producer H.N. Yuen. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you can submit comments and find ways to reach us. You can also call us at 510-848-6767, extension 670. And thanks to Erica Bridgman, who is at the controls today.